This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me is the High Performance Coach for the Country Women, Zoe Carr. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, the far less impressive guest for the day.
Well, we will come back to who our guest is at the moment. You can potentially hear him. We are sitting in the gaze room. You probably won't get a room named after him when he leaves here, but he'll probably get the coffee machine maybe at the end of this. As we mentioned last week, you can follow along on the socials on Twitter and Instagram using the @TalkingSplit handle if you want to interact with anything we say along the way. As we mentioned previously, we do want to acknowledge any coaches that are putting in work for a lot of other people. We know that it's a largely volunteer profession, so any shout-outs that you have for coaches in that area that you want to acknowledge the work they put in, by all means send them through and we will shout them out on this. We got a little bit of a different one this week. It was sent in by someone, I won't out them on this, but they write, "I hope this is okay as I know you asked for a coach, but when I think of people that have given so much of their time for basketball, I can't think of anyone who's done more than Wendy Campbell. Most people would know Wendy as the stalwart team manager for the Vic Country State teams, but her generosity and care reaches far beyond that. Wendy has been heavily involved in clubland for over 30 years to ensure that young country girls and boys have the same opportunities and experiences as those that live in the city. She will be forever the heart and soul of country Victorian basketball, so thank you very much, Wendy." So she was also your team manager, Zoe, not to age her out completely.
Yes, it would have been 20 years ago. Actually, it was exactly 20 years ago. Yep, under 20s.
Yep. So once again, if you do have anyone out in the world that you are looking to pass on some thanks to, please do let us know and we are more than happy to pass that on. We did mention previously that we have another guest in the room. So this has been a long time coming now, making his second appearance on the podcast, I might add. Did make one very, very early days and the look on his face would suggest he doesn't remember it. But it was a good one. I remember that. But we are really fortunate this week to have Bill Mildenhall on the podcast. So he's been an icon in the refereeing and officiating space, in particular with Basketball Victoria, Basketball Australia, and in the FIBA space. He's in his last week of work at Basketball Victoria, oddly enough, and he's probably been the most successful transition from the AFL to the basketball world out of everyone we've had in there. So, Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rob. You've highlighted something already that I can't quite remember that last time I've been there.
No, it's okay.
We didn't have these big microphones.
No, we absolutely didn't. Yeah, no, okay. Definitely not.
Well,
no,
that makes sense.
It was a little bit more subdued in that space. Yeah. I think we just spoke
that
into
was the
a
old laptop day.
I think it was.
I think it was.
Yeah. We literally just spoke into a laptop and hoped for the best.
Oh, now I feel much better now. Goodness.
We did mention, like, it's been a heck of a career, both on and off the floor. Like, we sort of hate to think how many referees that the Bills had an impact on over the years. I certainly know, and I don't publicise this often, that I did go through a referee course when I was back at Diamond Valley, and Bill took the course.
Oh, really?
So it was, this is how far back we are going. So I think I was 17-ish at the time.
And really worked well. You obviously didn't referee from then on.
Did 10 years, thanks, Bill.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. You do less for a crime. Oh, like it's, but no, did 10 years of refereeing, but went to the coaching side. So that's okay. You taught me a lot. So no issues there. But we sort of mentioned it a couple of times. Referees and coaches are kind of like oil and water in a lot of spaces. Like they have two very different mentalities about what they're doing, why they're doing it, how they're going to do it in that space. And no matter what, there's usually heated discussion around who's doing it better and what they're doing in that sort of space. And like I know over our time at Basketball Victoria, I usually loved the Monday mornings when we used to sort of work in that same area where it'd be, hey, come and have a look at this. And you'd get a little bit of a look in as to what's happened over the weekend. Okay, give me the perspective from the coaches. Give me this perspective from the referees. Where do we sit on this? What's the right call? And there were plenty of times, I wouldn't say it got heated, but there was certainly some fairly frank discussion about what should have happened. And we'd be no closer to an actual outcome at the end of it, despite having watched it back a dozen times, talked it through so many times. It just happens. And that's something that our sport creates. It's not a black and white sport. So there's so much grey in that. I think that's kind of the fun part of it. As much as it may not feel like it at the time, it's kind of the fun part of it. So, I mean, Bill, it's, you know, how long have you, like, when did you ref your first game of basketball? How old were you at that stage?
I think I was about 17.
Yep.
So I was playing junior basketball with Melbourne Tigers. Oh, no, not with Melbourne Tigers, St Kilda Police Boys Club. And that doesn't exist any longer. I then realised that I was going out of into under-18s and I thought, oh, I'm not going to be good enough to play under-18s or whatever. So I still wanted to maintain some involvement in the sport and it was a means of earning pocket money. So I took up officiating and that's how it all began.
So how, like, how different is the landscape now compared to when you first started in terms of opportunities for referees to be involved, like how many games they can ref, the levels they can ref, where the game can actually take you? Because I'm tipping, you know, it took you to pretty much Albert Park when Correct. You were 17, but nowhere else after
yeah.
that.
Well, virtually, yeah. That's where we – I think Coburg was also in existence at that stage. But apart from that, was all the games were being played at Albert Park, which in some ways was great because you just – if you wanted to work and you wanted to get some money and whatever, you could just lob on a whatever night it was that you wanted to referee and you'd just walk in. We had this system where you were on spec. So in other words, if people didn't turn up, you could fill in. So you'd fill in the gaps and you'd earn some money. And so, which was really good. It gave you a lot of flexibility. So from that perspective, it was just so different from what we currently see now. I mean, the landscape, even though it was a different venue and so on, the landscape was still pretty much the same. But, you know, I don't think it's sort of changed that much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting how the game evolves. Like, the game has changed a lot, obviously, since when you would have first started. Bigger, stronger, more athletic, probably better IQ and knowledge. Like, it's more of a world game now, I suppose. There's been more access into different parts of the world to see what's going on than it probably would have been at the very start.
Well, I even think that's even happening even more so now, Rob, with technology the way that it is. And if I just sort of judge my kids, you know, reactions to watching NBA and so on all the time, I mean, they're forever on their phones looking at the games. And so that wasn't available back in the early days. And obviously basketball was it. I mean, when I first started, it was at its sort of infancy stages, really, compared to what it is. You know, with the number of venues that we have around the place, it's just a good example.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. There's just the growth, in particular the last probably the 10 years, I suppose, with the access to things like NBA and EuroLeague and those types of things. It's just exploded.
So when we talk about technology, Bill, what do you think technology has helped, the introduction of technology has helped officiating with obviously things like, you know, the introduction of challenges and multiple angles and all those sort of slow-mo replay, all that sort of stuff that wasn't available in the same sort of state that it's in now. Do you think that's something that, I mean, is a positive for refereeing?
I think there's two sides to that, Zoe, where there's the one side of it, from our perspective in education and training, it's an absolute bonus, the fact that you can, because in the old days we'd sort of come in after a game and, you know, we would be coached, and the way we would be coached is that they'd review the game and you have to remember the actual incidences that happened and try to, reflect back on what you saw or how you saw it and so on, which in lots of ways that's still really quite handy. But now you're the ability to review things off a video, and you can get it on your phone even. You can just go back and, oh, let's have a look at this play, and we go back and have a look and so on. So the immediate education is perfect. The other sides of things are, the aspects of coaches being able to review things and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure. I'm probably old school, but I tend to think that there are so many decisions, which we'll probably talk about, decisions in a game which can go either way and can be, you know, there's a lot of grey in the game, which makes it an entertaining game. So when we're sort of trying to cut out those greys, I think it sort of takes away from the elements of the game that we originally had. And it, like if things go your way, they seem to flow in your direction and whatever. Now, you know, you can challenge that. And I don't like the sort of the breaks that you actually have to be able to sort of challenge and to see the, you know, review a decision. However, we have to embrace change, and that's the way that it is. I mean, you look at every other sport virtually, they're all in a similar circumstance. So, it is what it is, and we have to embrace that.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, two things probably need to change. One, a screen that turns around.
Yes.
And
I originally had those. I don't know what's happened since.
But two, I also wholeheartedly believe that coaches staff shouldn't get the opportunity to review it before challenging, because if the referees have to call in real time, then the challenge should have to call in real time.
That's a very good point, actually, because, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on you. I mean, and I've only been involved in the challenges from sitting on the sidelines and sort of being one of those to assist, and I don't think I did that very well at different stages. again, my decision-making was pretty much, oh, let's give the benefit of the doubt to this way, whereas now you can't really have a benefit of out so much. So, yeah, I would agree with you, though, that coaches sit on the side. They're able to look at the play and then make the decision to challenge. I think that's,
bit of an unfair advantage for mine.
Jeez, I feel for the poor little video guy, too, that's usually in the back that's like when you've got like...
Who's normally like the third or fourth assistant, too.
A volunteer that just wants to be there and help out, and all of a sudden you've got the head coach looking at you, should we challenge this? And it's like, oh, this is the weight of the world. Like, if we use this challenge now and I'm wrong, we need it in the fourth, like, what happens?
Well, Rob, you can imagine the pressure also of the person who's the referee person looking at it. Yeah. I was panicking. You know, I'd sit there and think, oh, for goodness sake, please don't have a challenge, because now then you've got... You're under so much pressure and so much scrutiny, and whereas if you make a decision in the game, the chances are you've made the decision, you move on, and we don't have the sort of the return back to what it was like. So, you know, when you're sitting on the bench, I used to hate it. You know, I'd be praying that we didn't have a challenge.
And you're just hoping that both teams lose their challenge early on, and it's like, I'm out for the game.
Yeah, exactly. You can go and have a rest. Go and have a coffee.
Ordered the
or
pizza.
Or just watch the game from the sideline. Best seats in the house.
It's so much easier. So how do you keep up? Like, I know you were involved with a lot of the rule changes in FIBA in that space in particular, and you know, we're blaming you for the travel rule that is currently in place at the moment. How do you keep up with things like that if you are an official? Because I know from a coaching perspective, like, we've been asked about the zero step, and I think every course I ever deliver, I'll get a question about, is this travel? Why is this called? And it's usually, this got called yesterday in my domestic game. It's like, hey, perspective, this is not a massive deal, but... It's really difficult for us to teach as coaches. And someone that used to work in the BV office, we were talking about Tim Mills, we were having this discussion about the zero step in particular, and it's like, when are you guys going to get your head around it as referees? And it's like, well, we can't get our head around it until you guys start using it, and we have to see it on court, and then we can work it out. And it's like, damn it, Tim's right. Like, it's,
gotcha.
You know, it kind of annoyed me a little bit on that one. I'm still remembering it to this day, but it's that kind of thing. Like, how do you keep on top of the rule changes? Because what I remember, like, this is, you know, Bill 101 when he was going through my ref school. If it looks different, it's probably travel. So just call it. But now it's so different.
You can't say that now.
No.
You can't do that. Yeah. Rob, do you understand the reasons why they made the change?
Not completely, to be fair.
FIBA made the change. Yeah. I mean, it was from the NBA initially. And the reason was mainly because referees couldn't make the travel. And more to do, it could make appropriate decisions in the first place. And secondly, it was the reverse spin move that players were using, and technically it was a travel because they'd lift their pivot foot, they'd reverse spin around on their one foot and then put that pivot foot back down again and make the basket. It was a great play. It looked fantastic. The NBA were doing it, and as a consequence, FIBA had to change the rule to now allow that to exist. And so then it has the ramifications of where it goes from there. I was never very good at calling travels at the best of times, so I'm probably the worst person to ask. And my philosophy is, if it looked different, you call it, or if people yelled out enough, I'd call it. So that probably wasn't the great philosophy of a coaching tool. But now I would definitely struggle, because I think, and I mean, from the spectacle point of view, it's better to let it go anyway, even if it's, you know, if it's close or whatever, it's, you know, you tend to be sort of more inclined to let it go rather than picking it all up. There are times when I sit there now and watch games and go, oh, my gosh, you know, that's definitely a travel. That's a really big advantage to be gained. I mean, but the bottom line of it is also the FIBA philosophy is there has to be some sort of an advantage or a, you know, but again, your perception of an advantage and my perception can be poles apart.
Well, and that's where, you know, I think there does become a lot of player or coach versus referee angst, because, you know, you talk about from a foul perspective, and somebody fouls you and you're just bringing the ball up the floor, they say, well, there's no disadvantage there, no you're effect. Okay. Yep. But then from the other side, the coaches and the players are saying, hold on, that would be their fourth foul.
Correct.
Meaning they'd have to come out.
Correct.
There's an advantage there or a disadvantage advantage that, you know, you can play. So, yeah, it must – I don't envy you at all. I don't envy any referee at all. I mean,
that's been in place all the way along, you know, and again, it's a challenge for referees because there are some referees who use their understanding of the game and as a consequence don't necessarily make those particular calls. So then people can adjust and whatever. But unfortunately, your partner on the other side or your other two partners on the other side may not have the same philosophies, and then they're calling it the other way. So then you lose your the consistency component then goes out the window. So what do you have to do? You virtually have to follow what the rule says, you know, and that's basically – I would struggle big time now to referee because I used to be very, laissez-faire in terms of wanting to let the game progress and play properly. Now you could do that in my day, and so you can't talk about the old days. But you can't possibly do that now because there's video reviews, there's, you know, every decision is so scrutinised.
And the athletes are different too.
And the athletes know what they're doing. Like, and they understand what the rules are and they appreciate what, you know, hey, if I'm forcing you to take that extra step, then I should be rewarded for it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, so it changes enormously now as compared to what it did when I was first started out.
Yeah, I know it's something I talk about it a lot because obviously I deliver a lot of coaching courses and one of the things I usually try and leave the coaches with when I finish the course is, one, stay away from the refs. They're not your problem. Like, you've got enough dramas to deal with. Like, just try and stay off them, but also go through a course. Like, you don't have to end up being a ref at the end of it, but at least go through the course, understand what they're saying, understand why they have to do things a certain way, and just put yourself in that position. And I know the first time I jumped on court, and we didn't have green shirts back then, they were just plain white shirts and you hope for the best. I remember sitting there with a whistle going, hey, that's travel. Like, oh, that's my job.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the one that has to do something with that now. It's actually a really difficult thing to sort of work to go from. I think everyone can see it from 10 rows back.
Absolutely.
Like, when you don't have the pressure of having to run up and down, there's no fitness component, or you're not having to listen to a coach or a ref a player or crowds or anything like that. It's so much easier when you're so much further removed from it because you've just got time to be able to see what's going on.
Well, this plays into my hands perfectly because my theory is we should have. We could get by with one referee doing a game, you know, like a tennis umpire, you know, those stands that they have. My philosophy is you have the stand in the middle of the floor and the referee...
It's just like a big screen that you've got to try and work
so
around.
So you've got to get around that. And so the referee sits in the stand because, you know, as you said, when you're sitting in an elevated position, there's less pressure on you and you can see it quite comfortably and easily from there. And so, yeah, we could get to one referee. We don't need three. We just need one now. Then... And that person sits at the tennis umpire as a tennis umpire and then blows their whistle and makes decisions.
I think Bill's looking to crack the 1,000 game mark for NBL. Like, he feels like he can come back in fairly comfortably and just grab an extra couple of hundred.
I haven't worked out how you avoid, you know, running into the stand and all that sort
of
stuff.
Yeah, that might
be a problem. And how you administer things, you know.
Drones.
You could have one.
Drones. Well, here we go.
Yeah. You could have one on each side.
Well,
and
you could.
Then, you know, you take care of split line and below and towards you and...
You look at footy, that's why most of the coaches all sit in an elevated position now. They don't sit on the bench because they think they can see the game much, much better and make appropriate decisions. Basketball hasn't quite got to that stage, but it doesn't surprise me.
Smaller field, smaller court, area. I guess, maybe has something to do with
that. Maybe, Rob, you could start, Zoe, you could start maybe a new trend of sitting in the stands as a coach.
Be honest, I've never lost a game from the stands, so there might be something to this.
There's that, and the... Only people that get smashed in the stands more than referees are the coaches. So we'll stay away from the stands.
This is very true, unfortunately. So how big an impact, I'm thinking back to when you were reffing in particular, how big an impact did the coach have on how you reffed that game? Was there something that you would sort of go into that game thinking of, I've got this coach and this is how I'm going to have to treat them or deal with them? Or did that ever play a part?
If I'm totally honest, yes, it would.
Yep.
It would definitely make you were very conscious of the coaches whom you were who were playing in that game. And we would also have a bit of a discussion prior to the game with your partners, with your referees, and say, listen, we've got so-and-so. We need to deal with him right from the very beginning or we have somebody else whom we can give a little bit of rope towards and allow them to sort of comment. So there would be, you'd go out with your experience, you'd go out with in some ways not preconceived ideas, but you'd have an understanding of what this coach is capable of doing. Now, that may have had an unfair advantage as well, because you might say, because this coach goes off his tree right from the very beginning and we know that he's going to react this way, so therefore we'll give him a lot more line. Whereas the other coach who's, toes the line completely and then just goes off on the one occasion and he gets pinged, because – and then it looks so –
because it's out of character.
Yeah, totally out of character zone. Yeah.
So what you're saying is be a jerk all the time.
Don't do that, coaches. Please don't do that.
The other option is you be nice all the time, Zoe. So that's the difference, you see. And I would suggest that probably being nice all the time would be more beneficial than the other way around. So it is hard, Rob. You do go out. Look, you shouldn't have preconceived ideas. And even from my international experiences, you would go and observe the games that particularly – and you didn't want the first game. You always, would like to sort of see the teams that are playing – and you'd make some judgment on your own behalf about how particular coaches react and how the players react as well. And some will, overreact and so therefore you'd go out with the intent that, okay, if this gets out of hand, I'm going to jump on this pretty smartly because I know it's going to get worse as it progresses. Or if I've noticed that the coach very rarely says much. I mean, from that perspective, usually if they don't say a lot and then they do say something, then you tend to take a lot more notice of that than somebody who makes a comment every single call you make.
Yeah, and that's the difficult part, I suppose, between the two is, there's just noise. Although there's not, there's always going to be talking that goes on and stuff like that. And I suppose as the ref too, you've got to work out what is directed at you versus what is directed at the players versus what's instructional and those types of things.
Also, Rob, smart coaches – directed at the player, but you know that full well it's
directed at you.
Yeah, you hear the comment like, I know they're holding you on that screen, absolutely. But I need you to fight through that instead. Yeah, yeah.
So coaches don't think that the referees are smart enough to realise that.
It's funny though, because I know from our end, I've presented a couple of times to the junior panel refs at the start of a season about what coaches go through, what we sort of want from them. And I know, Zoe, you've done it as well for the WNBL officials that we're going through as to these are the types of actions you might see in a game. You might see a screen over on that wing. You might see a cross screen here, or you might see a post player that will play this way. And here's how they'll get them the ball, depending on how it's defended. Do referees go that in depth, I suppose, into what they're about to see in a game?
I can only answer on my own experiences, pretty much, and no.
Yep.
in essence, I mean, I used to think it was an advantage to have played and have some, but I certainly couldn't be as intense, like I couldn't coach a team and sort of and feel confident enough to, yet a lot of people would say. Now, there are some referees whom are more directed along those lines. I was never really down that path. So I really, and then I'm not saying it, I don't think that was necessarily good from my perspective. I would have preferred to have a much better understanding. But my playing experience is finished at under 18 level and I didn't get to experience, whereas we've had some ex NBL players or CBL players or even state championship players come back and referee, and I think they have a massive advantage on a number of fronts. One, that they understand what the players are trying to achieve and the plays they're trying to use, and the other part, they've got some empathy as to what how the players are sort of operating and what frustrates them and annoys them and so on. Whereas the majority of us referees haven't really experienced that at a high level.
It's a difficult spot to be in. Like I remember was coaching a game and was having a chat to the ref that was standing in front of me when it was just free throws and there was nothing. It was one of the few times I probably wasn't complaining, but it was just having a chat to him. And he's like, you got to be really careful because on the weak side, your big continues to hit the player off the ball before the screen happens. And it's like, one, appreciate the heads up, because now I can at least go to them and say, hey, you've been busted on this thing, do not do it a second time. But also really appreciated the fact that they had a bit of an understanding knowledge as to what was going on in that space too. I think you're right, like if you've played at a level, and I suppose you look at someone like a Paul Rifle type that umpires cricket internationally, like was a very good player obviously for Australia, but then moved into that officiating side of things, he probably comes with a different perspective all together. Like, they know what it's like to be on the road for, you know, potentially a week on end because they've been through that as a player. So it does bring like a level of knowledge, I suppose.
To my knowledge, Rob, I don't think we have very many referees who have actually achieved like a Paul Rifle, you know, that's achieved as a player to fairly high level, I mean test level even, and then come back and officiate.
What do you think that is? Is there any reason why they wouldn't jump back in? Like, is it just because they hated refs when they were a player and they didn't want to be sort of aligned?
They probably realised how stupid the referees are.
It's probably harder in basketball too because of the activity. Like, if you're going to stop playing, you're probably stopping because your body can't take it anymore and then adding reffing.
It's a very good question though because if a player finishes at 34 or 5, there's no reason.
They can still get up there.
It's a perfect age to actually take up officiating. We did sort of follow, when I first started working with BA, we did try and target, and I would sort of run around and do some special courses for it just reminded me actually, that we'd do courses for ex-players and coaches to sort of, and I did it at Albert Park a few times. I'm trying to think of somebody whom we would...
Dave Simmons was one.
Yeah, Dave Simmons. I worked really hard with Dave Simmons actually. That's how I became sort of quite friends with him, simply because he used to come down every lunchtime when we were at Albert Park and we'd go through the processes of officiating and so on. And he did, you're right, and that's the perfect example. And I sort of worked really, it was all his doing. I was just there, to assist, but that was an interesting exercise. But he didn't like it after all. I don't think he sort of, he didn't pursue it too much.
So we talk about though, you know, players and coaches going through courses and gaining that knowledge of officiating. What is it actually like, though, to ref one of those players that know all the rules, probably as much as you do as a referee? Like, I remember hearing referees talk about Sean Redditch from Perth Wildcats, that, you know, he was to the point where he knew whose position, whose call it should have been, what it should have been, what class it was supposed to be, all this sort of stuff. What's it like reffing somebody like that?
It's a good question, Zoe. I don't think I've ever had that question asked of me. And secondly, I've never really thought about it because it's not something that sort of bothered me. I probably haven't experienced anybody at an NBL level. It's not that common that you're going to have somebody who's sort of who's refereed at a reasonably high level. There was a guy named Kevin Marsh who played in the NBL, and he played NBL, then went to refereeing and actually refereed NBL. You know, like, which was a really that's an unusual, and that hasn't happened again. But I think he had a really good rapport with the players because everybody was able to refer to him, and knowing full well that, one, he's a player, and two, he was a quality player, and that, you know, he was one of them, basically, if you like, to that really helped. I can't really answer that question.
Well, you mentioned, though, the rapport with players and obviously rapport with coaches, and you're someone who is known far and wide for having great relationships with players and coaches, if it's just a, you know, professional one, and your ability to, you know, speak to people, have them speak to you and have those conversations that we see a lot of the time do have the ability to get out of hand. And you had a great just way of, I guess, turning that into more of a conversation and de-escalating. What was your trick? How did you do that?
I honestly don't know, and if I did know, I'd try and pass it on.
I'd pass it on
to every referee. But I guess it was just my normal personality and just the way that part of it is I think that I was always trying to be honest. You know, like if I know that I've screwed up, I'm sort of more open about being able to express that and to admit to having made a mistake. Mind you, you can't do it on too many occasions.
That's our fifth 50-50 that you've gone the other way.
Or, I got that wrong, you know. Or then the comment will often be, you know, I said, look, I think I screwed up on that one. Yeah, but don't do it again, you know. So you sort of, maybe the fact that I played another sport and I sort of had some sort of understanding of elite sport at a different level. So that probably helped a little bit. And it was just but when I think about it, right from the very beginning, I was sort of just my personality, I guess, was such that I'd sort of communicate with people, and I wasn't one of those that, and I used to get criticised by the hierarchy of officiating for not giving technical fouls, so because I would sort of try and win people over in other ways rather than issue a technical foul. So from that perspective, it's different. I'd hate to be refereeing now, though, because it is so. The accountability is massive. You know, everything is shown in replay 400 times in different angles and so on and so on. So, you know, in our circumstance, in my time, and I used to sort of mention this to, you know, if it's a close out of bounds and one team is sort of 10 behind, you give it to the team who are 10 behind. You know, everybody's happy and everyone walks away. And now you can't do that. They'll show that on replay and they go, yeah, how did you get that decision? That's terrible. You know, whereas we could sort of, and it was managing the game a little better. And it was sort of managing the game. Unfortunately, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, fitness test is probably one thing that you wouldn't be overly thrilled about at the moment having to go through. Like it's, I don't know, no. The last time Bill pulled on a ref shirt to actually ref, we got a phone call here at the Basketball Victoria offices saying, we need a ref from this advertising agency. And they're like, oh, yeah, we don't really have anyone. Like, you know, what do you need them to do? Oh, we just need to stand and referee this fake game for a Milo commercial.
That and Milo commercial still runs.
It does still run. Yeah, yeah. Every now and again, you see that.
Can I get, payment for that or anything now or whatever? Goodness.
Residuals?
Yeah, that's what
they'll send you massive tins of Milo. So yeah. Bill pulled on the ref shirt. Went and did it, tore his calf whilst...
That's right, it was out at Footscray. I vividly remember, I did. But first time I ran up the side, it fell over.
But the rapport side of things is something, and I mean, I look at it from a lot of the officials we have at the moment, because referees can start so young, like it's nothing for a 15-year-old to be refereeing a game, 14, depending on some of the places around the spot too. A lot of referees don't really have that life skill of being able to communicate with players, coaches, and whoever else is going on. So, they're
especially people old enough to be their parents,
without a doubt. Yeah. Like so I feel for the young ones in particular that are like trying to fight their way through and learn how to be an official in that space. Their only recourse when confrontation happens is a tech, and that's something that you can't just get that experience. Like, you've got to spend time as a referee to do it.
And that's true, Robert. And that's one of the concerns that I think society has changed so much, you know, in lots of ways. And so that's had a massive impact on even coaches sort of react immediately and they don't think about what their reactions are. And so as a consequence, then you get young kids and young referees whom haven't really had the experiences or the understanding or the ability to deal with those sort of things. So the immediate reaction for them is use the whistle or give a technical foul or whatever and react that way simply because they don't know any different. And also society is such that you're not encouraged to challenge anymore. You're not encouraged to question a policeman. Can you imagine, you know, a policeman pulls you over and you challenge the cop? You know, you've got no chance whatsoever. And so that's society's changed. You just have to cop it on the chin. So that's also, I think, permeates through to sport. Whereas, hey, that person's in charge, they blow the whistle, they make the decision, you say nothing. Whether you agree or disagree with it, you've just got to accept it.
Yep. So if, and I'm not suggesting coaches do this, so stick with me on this, if a ref or a coach wants to talk to a referee during a game, what is the best way for them to go about that? So to the point where they're not overbearing, demeaning, disrespectful, all those types of things, because we do see it a fair bit. Like, it is, you know, there's been some instances of late in particular in domestic basketball where young officials have been treated fairly poorly. It'd be fair to say, what is the best way to go about it so they don't feel threatened, I suppose, as part of it too?
That is a really good question, because I'm not now currently sure of how you go about doing that anymore. I'd like to think, I mean, within the rules, you could actually, and I haven't seen this happen, you know, but technically it says you call a timeout and then you can go and approach the referee. And I don't think I don't know whether you two have ever experienced this, but if I think what you're questioning was relevant, I in fact can withdraw the timeout and we can go on and you keep your timeout.
The old unofficial challenge.
Have you ever seen that happen?
Never.
No.
And it's never happened. I think I've done that once in my whole career.
You made up the rule, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I made it. I'm sure. I don't. In fact, I'd be challenged now. Probably it doesn't even exist. So, but the best option is during the timeout. But again, I understand coaches want to use their timeout for lots of other reasons, and not, you know, whether the timing of it or whatever is not necessarily. I suggest maybe, and I'm not guaranteeing this would happen, but rather than actually approaching the referee at the beginning of the timeout, that you actually break the kids up, you know, the timeout up, and then just have your little comment or your little rapport with the referee when you've settled down, probably. And secondly, it's a much cooler environment at the end of the timeout than it is at the beginning of the timeout. Now, you have to attract the attention of the referee, and you have to go through all those sort of processes, which is not easy. So, and see, the referees have this philosophy that you shouldn't be talking to me anyway. Yep. You know, so that you're on a hiding
straight away. It's difficult,
absolutely, because you know, behind the eight ball to begin with. So, and I mean, the options I would generally say is, look, ref, you know, we're not pitching. You know, you're being really calm and you're being in control. But just say, would you mind having a look at such and such or whatever? Or if it's a call that they've made, I understand your call. Can you just explain, you know, what they did? So, because I want to, you know, bullshit on. I want to teach my players not to do it again. You know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that's a really big part of it too. And we try and tell coaches, this is not a philosophical debate. Yeah. Ask your question, get your answer, leave it be. It's not a back and forth.
Absolutely, Rob. You can't. You know, and first off,
you don't have time.
Yeah, and secondly, you know, they're not going to change their decision. I've never seen anybody change their decision because the coach said to them, "Oh, that was the wrong call" or whatever. I mean, it doesn't happen. I mean, and when you're instructed not to do that, you know, even though you know you've made a mistake, and I encourage referees to do this, and I haven't seen it happen very often, but if you, you know, like say, guy goes up to take a shot and gets blocked, and you thinking, you know, like you're anticipated that he was going to get fouled because the defenders come from nowhere or whatever, and you blow your whistle and you go, oh, no, you know, like he's blocked the shot cleanly. I have been known to, hey, sorry, my mistake, that's a jump ball, he didn't foul. That gains a hell of a lot of respect from players and coaches alike, but you have to have a lot of courage to do it.
Yeah, well, I know there was a Nationals I was reffing at, and a Victorian ref had me actually, and I'm like, and it happened right in front of our bench. It was the dodgy out of bounds call, it went the other way, and I'm like, I reckon you owe us a call there. He's like, I reckon I might too. Yeah. And it's like, oh. Okay, no, we're good. Like, and like, we still have this joke now. Like, if I see him, it's like, mate, you still owe me a call from like 2016. He's like, yeah, look, eventually you got to let that go.
But exactly. But Rob, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to give the call the next call that's going to turn around.
Yep.
And I mean, and coaches know if you bitch and complain, they're not going to change their call. I mean, you know that right from the very beginning. But also, and referees have to understand that the coach knows he's not going to change the call. But he's using that as a means of trying to change your next decision or your one after that or your one after that, that sort of maybe a bit touchy and goes in your favour instead of going against you. And look, there's relevance in that. There's no doubt that there is something.
And I think one of the really important things to do if you are going to try and engage a referee is use their name.
Yeah.
I can't even stand hearing on the side, ref, yeah, ref. Yeah. I certainly wouldn't answer to it. I don't even let my kids call me coach, and that's a basketball thing is to be called coach. But you know, using their name and treating them like human beings, that's a great start.
Well, it is human nature. I mean, it's sort of, if you start off on the, and I'm very much in favour of going up and shaking hands with the coaches or referees at the beginning, simply because you start off on, I've always read this in a referee magazine, that if you don't start off on the positive foot right from the very beginning, the very next time that you speak to the coach or the coach speaks to the referee is going to be a negative. They're going to be bitching about something. They're going to be complaining. So you haven't started in any way, shape or form on a positive. You know, so it, you know, I would encourage coaches to go up and shake the hands of referees and just say, you know, good luck. Some referees don't like it, but by the same token, I think you're starting off on the right foot.
Yep.
And you want to build as best a rapport you possibly can. And, you know, if you come across as being a nice person, then the tendency is, and I think, Rob, that's what helped my officiating. I wasn't dogmatic and I wasn't sort of aggressive towards. I mean, I've, at times, I said, you give me no option, I've got a tech failure. Mm. You know, like that's yeah. stupid.
There's easy ones.
Yeah, like the, yeah. but yeah. I can't do anything more than technical failure. You know?
Well, there's that video that's doing the rounds at the moment. Yeah, is it a EuroLeague?
It is. I'll
referee?
Try and drop the audio into this as of now, so you're going to hear the post-production. But we'll see how it goes. But yeah, continue.
But basically saying he's mic'd up for the yeah. game and a coach is in his ear about a call and he just says to him, I'll remind you, you still have your challenge. And the, you know, yeah. the coach has a laugh, he has a laugh, and yeah. they move on. And then, you know, they're in their meeting or their little sort of huddle, whether it's a timeout or a quarter time or something. And he said, look, I'll just – it's something along the lines of, and if the audio is about to play, I apologise if I'm wrong.
You're completely right.
But it says he says something along the lines of, remember – we are firefighters to the fire. We're not bringing gas or something like that. Right. It's something, you know, yeah. so basically we're trying to de-escalate things and, you know, just talk to them and have those conversations yeah. and things like that. And that's one thing I've always, you know, we give shout outs to coaches all the time, but from a refereeing perspective, particularly in the NBL one here in South, Dean McCarthy is one of the best referees I think I've ever had. Now, has he got it 100% right all Correct. Of the time? No, but neither have I as a coach. The difference is you can always have a conversation with him. He's willing to admit when he does, you know. I remember the first time he said to me, and this is one of the reasons I actually remembered his name the first time he reffed one of the games I was coaching was I said, there was an out-of-bounds call and I said, are we sure we got that right? And he said, well, it was 50-50 and this is the way I saw it. And I went, okay.
Fair enough.
Like, no worries. Yeah. And, you know, when those things have happened, he has that communication and, you know, there's been times where it's like, hey, I'm not sure about that. And he'll go, you know, and we'll have that banter and, you know, so I will still ask questions of him and challenge him on things, but it's never in an aggressive anger place because of his demeanor and to be honest it should be something I can manage myself, but he goes a long way because of his demeanor and his ability to communicate with coaches. And you see it when he coaches in any of the games, you know, sometimes with coaches, you know, are a little bit dicey. He's just got a way of being able to, you know, be the firefighter in that situation. So, you know, shout out to Dean. Hopefully
there's
he listens.
Lots of,
so he's trying to get calls next time.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
I don't coach a team. Thanks very much. That was 100%
sincere.
And I say, as you would know, no, I actually do say it all the time of, you know, when we watch games that probably aren't being handled all so well, it's like this game needs
Dean. What you've identified, though, Zoe, is honest. You can't put, unfortunately, you can't put someone's personality, you can't take a personality from somewhere and put it in somebody else. And obviously he's a good communicator, has a good understanding of the game and has a good rapport with the coaches and so on. And all of that helps enormously. And I can tell you, I promise you, in my officiating, I mean, in my time, there were a number of referees who were far more accurate than I was, but I seemed to sort of progress a little quicker or more than they did simply because of my rapport and understanding with people, you know, and I'd be the first to admit that I wasn't very accurate, but I was able to get along with people and I think that really helped. The unfortunate thing is now society has changed so much and we have to embrace that. I refer back to I was a teacher originally, you know, like I'd hate to be teaching now, you know, because kids had so much more respect for a teacher. They wouldn't challenge a teacher. They wouldn't question. They wouldn't, you know, they didn't want to get into trouble. Now they wanted to go out and challenge
teachers. Yeah, they're trying to push boundaries.
Absolutely pushing the boundary the whole time, Rob. And that has, to me, that has a massive impact on everything. It has an impact particularly in sport because they've been brought up with this idea that I am allowed to challenge. And even from a personal home front perspective, I mean, kids, I've got two lots of, you know, families basically, my older group, they would never challenge or question what they're doing, but now my younger ones challenge you all the time. You know,
thanks,
because
Google.
Yeah. And it has, and it's all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, like, and they're on their phones, they know what they're able to do and they can push your buttons and whatever else. So we have to embrace the change and we can't keep referring back to what it was like in the old days. I mean, you made reference before, I was going to bring up about when we'd come in here and we'd have discussions in the office and so on. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen anymore, even though we have players and coaches, sorry, coaches and referees in the same sort of office. But I used to enjoy, because it was a great, you know, but it's also a learning phase from my perspective. I was able to understand what coaches were trying to achieve and what they were doing and what they saw as being important. As to what I saw as important, we could have been poles apart on lots of occasions. As a consequence, you know, by being able to talk to people, you get a real better understanding of the game. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen in either anymore.
Yeah, I learned about a secondary defender for the first time in those discussions. Like, I'd never heard of, like, you know, the second defender has to give a step. Like, when the hell did that rule come in? Like, it's they got there first. That's what it's supposed to. But it is a big thing.
I think, and I've said this for a long time, and I understand there's probably some. If there are any referees listening, there's probably some of them saying, Zoe, you are major hypocritical right now. Putting my hand up to say it. I try. I do try. But I think we need to do work on bridging the gap between coaches and referees. Like, we're in this together. At the end of the day, we don't need coaches, we don't need referees, we need players, and that's who this is all about. Correct. And especially when we're talking about juniors, like, this is about the kids. And, you know, so all those things from a – we talk often about how to engage with referees in a respectful manner and you know, make sure we're not being demonstrative and all that sort of stuff. We talk about, you know, the referees. Sharon Arnold was another great one that you know, I remember when she used to ref us, I remember it explicitly. We were in Adelaide, Wavell Stadium, playing against the Lightning. We were down three. We only had one possession left, so we needed to foul to try and put them to the line. We come out of our timeout. Sharon walks up to me and says, "Are you fouling?"
Fail.
Yeah, and it was like, "Yes, we are." She goes, "Great." So there was none of this baiting into an unsportsmanlike foul or anything like that.
Yep.
Just game control. And so as players and coaches, whenever Sharon walked in, we're like, "Great," because we know she's across everything, you know, from a knowledge perspective as well. And I think having those relationships between referees and coaches, or, you know, maybe not junior players as such, but yeah, definitely so coaches, yes, right. Is really important, because that's how you find those things out. Like you said, like, you found out about secondary defenders, you find out what's important, you know, what we're trying to achieve as coaches. Yeah. And I just think those things, that they need to happen more often.
I think you've made a good point, Zoe. We're really talking probably, most of our discussion is probably at the elite end a little bit, yeah, but at the lesser end, it's a little bit different again. Because one, the people who are officiating your games, they don't have the life skills. They don't have the ability, you know, they don't have any of those sort of skills that we're all saying, oh, you've got to be a communicator, you've got to listen, you've got to do all these, you know, whiz-baz things.
They haven't had time yet.
No, absolutely right. Yeah. And so, but what bothers me is that we're now sort of going down the path, I think, that we're not teaching them how to deal the other way. And so what we're tending to do is, hey, the coaches coach, the players play, they're told not to speak to the referee, and the coaches shouldn't be challenging or questioning referees either. And simply, now if you go out of over that line, then what referees are being instructed, that's a technical foul. Mm. And I understand that, because that's what the rules are stating.
And there needs to be some, like, safeguarding type against officials being abused too.
The unsportsmanlike clear path foul first came in.
Yes.
And it was getting called by the letter of the law. Yeah. To the letter of the law, the referees were right. But it infuriated everybody because it was, you know, you're trying to foul, like we were talking about before, in that instance where, you know, you're trying to create extra possessions and all that sort of stuff. There was no malice in it and all that, all those sort of things. But by the letter of the law, that's what they're bound to do as referees. And as coaches, we need to understand, and players, we need to be understanding of that.
What we also used to say, though, I guess, and still continue to say, is coaches need to teach their players how to do it correctly, though.
Yeah.
You know, rather than
just grabbing them. Grabbing their arms.
Giving you another option of, you know, because you've got to understand what the other coach thinks as well. You know, you're sort of, it's interesting, we're talking about coaches that, I used to always instruct referees, and I would still continue to do so. I'm more concerned about the behaviour of the players rather than coaches, in terms of how players are reacting to my calls. So if they're accepting my calls and everyone seems to be flowing along smoothly, then I think that's a really good sign that things are going okay. I don't care terribly much about what the coaches are doing because half the time they think their responsibilities are to try and get those 50%ers going our way and then the other way. Also challenge the referees to make them always be on the ball. So from a coaching perspective, a referee perspective, I want the players to be happy. I want them to be accepting and own up to a foul and, you know, they know full well. Then you feel really – I feel really good. I don't really care what the coaches, you know, because I understand what you're trying to do and you have a different philosophy from – but if the players – and so if the game flows – and that helps your cause. The game flows, the coaches aren't going to bitch anyway terribly much and the players aren't bitching either and the game goes well. It's when they start to complain – I used to get really concerned about the behaviour of the players and think, so I talk to my partners and say, hey, you know, maybe we're not calling this the right way. You know, maybe we need to tighten up. Maybe we need to do this. Maybe we need to do that and make some sort of an adjustment because the players aren't behaving the way we'd like.
I have managed to find the audio. And again, we may need to do some editing of this in post, but we'll see how it sort
God,
of plays
God, I hope it. I get it right.
He's not grabbing. He's going for the ball on the back. Thomas, I want just remind you that you still have the chance for the head coach challenge if you're so sure. Just remember, if we have a lot of passion, we are like firemen, okay? We are not replying to put gasoline on the fire, we are just putting water. Easy, we have a stop. We have a stop down there.
I'm sorry, I'm just so ready.
I know. I don't want to guess. Thomas, I don't want to guess. I want to be sure. From my side, he's excellent, no call. He is looking for the contact every time. Just, if later on you want to spend foul on 21, make it right. Don't go for a sportsmanlike. If you want to spend a foul on him because he's a bad free throw shooter, don't try to do it in a correct way. Even if it's not easy, let's talk. Let's use the preventative officiating, okay? No, on the floor! No basket, on the floor!
From my side, the ball already stayed in the hand. There was a bump on the stomach.
Okay, do we go for a basket? Because you had better angle. Okay, basket. But he has the better open angle. You're testing, huh? Every time you're testing.
It's just phenomenal. Yeah.
We'll put that up on the Talking Split socials as well so people can see the video that goes with it as well because I think one of the ones that's great in that was the one with the player, you know, where the player's all hopped up and he's just trying to calm him down. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just always ready. Yeah. And, you know, like I think it's a really important video, I think, for coaches to see.
But they're perfect in terms of just their rapport with the players and
unbelievable,
coaches.
Isn't it?
Amazing.
Like, and you may mention... like as you were watching it, like the ref that stood side by side with the player. So it's non-confrontational straight away. You still have that open stance where you're seeing what's going on. They're talking side by side. It's just such a refreshing look on what officiating can look like. I mean, that's probably a little old school,
I would suggest. It is a little bit. I don't think they'd be allowed to do that as much now.
Yep.
The other bit I was interested in, they said the preventative officiating thing. I think we've got a misunderstanding of preventative officiating.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, preventing officiating is where you say something, which we may mention, I'll refer back to it. You say something to the coach or to the player, hey, watch so-and-so because he's holding on to somebody or he's doing something illegal and we're going to have to sort of pick up. That's preventative officiating. Preventative officiating is not get your hands out, because they've already done it. They're like, that's not preventing it. They've already done it. So, and unfortunately, we have this philosophy that preventive is that sort of style. It's to do with, and it doesn't have to be formal. It's a little whisper to somebody to say, hey, just be careful, you're getting close to pushing him in the back or whatever, you know, at the start of your dribble, you're shuffling your feet a bit, it's going to be close to a travel. That's preventative.
Yep.
Now, and players and coaches just respect you so much if you do that. And then you call it, they'll go, He told you what to do. He told you he was going to call it. You know, like, so that's prevented you.
Well, that's the – I remember vividly a night at Mill Park. One of my players got called for hand-checking. He turns around and he's like, oh, that's so soft. I'm like, mate, he told you four times coming down the floor, get your hand off. I have no leg to stand on here. I can't. Yes, it's soft, but I can't defend you on this. You got told what not to do, and you went and did it anyway. So it is that kind of thing. How do you go? Well, we talk about player feedback a lot here with how players respond to being coached in this space. You obviously do a lot of referee coaching and evaluating and those types of things too. How have you found the shift in referees receiving feedback? Because we certainly have more problems with it now, I feel like, with a younger generation coming through that do want to challenge you on everything. No, that's not what happened. It's like, well, the video says it did, so it probably did. Yep. But do you find the same thing?
It's very similar, Rob. Yeah. It is. That's society again.
Yep.
You know, they want to challenge whatever you throw forward to them, and that happens in society everywhere. The benefit that we have is like similar to you, and this is where the referee coaching has changed, is you try and have the vision there and then on the spot to be able to, because there's so many occasions previously when you talk about something and you can tell that the referee didn't agree with you. You know, the irony of all of that is, unbelievably, every referee, I'll guarantee you, remembers a particular play that, you know, like you bring up. If you don't have the vision, you talk about it and you give enough explanation, I'll guarantee you 90% of the time they will remember that play because it's been something that's bothered them or potentially bothered other people and there's been a reaction to it. So when they say, oh, I don't remember, I don't necessarily agree with that.
It's always easier.
Yeah, it's an easy way out. But then again, you have the option of having the vision and there's nothing, you know, you can't argue against the – now. There is arguments to say, oh, it's different angles and all that sort of stuff. And I understand that. But you just have to cop that on the chin. You know, like, from my angle, it wasn't like that. But boy, oh boy, I look foolish here. It's clearly a foul and I didn't call it. Yes, you know, that's fine.
Yep. What for you was the hardest call to get right in the game?
Oh, a charge block was without doubt. I mean, without a shadow of doubt. It's sort of – and you – I always used to call this, it's not you guesstimate. So you don't guess per se, Rob. You know, it's an estimated guess. But by the same token, you can, charge blocks is sort of one where you actually can really develop some consistency with your calling. You know, like if something looks the same at one end and it happens again at the other end, well, laughing. Just call it the same way you did. And if someone challenges you, say, yeah, look, it was really close and I'm not sure, but I call it that way, this way, so I'm going to call it the same way this end.
Yep.
And it, you know, you can't go to the extreme.
Yeah, but, good reason. Yep.
But if it's a tight one, then, you know, that's where I believe your consistency component really comes into play because with charge blocks you can, hey, we got one down the other end, we want to do – and most players and coaches will accept that. Because there is that sort of element of consistency with it, that it's a charge block is always really hard. You look at it, and then you go back, and you hope to cross. Then you know you go back on the video, and you think, oh, and then you slow it down frame by frame, and you see whether you know he's got his foot on the floor, or he hasn't, where does he get hit? I mean, the key really is I always would say to referees, just look where they get hit, the position of where they get hit. If they hit down the middle, you get a pretty good, it's a high percentage that's a charge.
Yeah, and it is a difficult one, and it's probably getting harder and harder with the way the game is played now. Like it is so much quicker now.
Yeah,
like you've got to try and get into position earlier. The no charge circle makes it probably a level of complexity again.
That is
that too. You know you've only got to be slightly inside that thing, and that's a problem as well. It's just difficult.
And the thing about it is, Rob, that we always instruct referees to, and particularly you, when you're sort of coming up through the system, that you've got to make a call. Just blow your whistle. I mean, you know, as coaches, I'm sure, it's much more frustrating when there's a massive collision and nobody – I know why they didn't call it, because they don't know what to call.
Yeah.
You know, and you just say, hey, pick one. Yep. Just pick one because you're going to keep control of the game this way. I understand you're not sure. And if the coach asks you and challenges you, just say, hey, listen, I'm not sure that I got that right, but all I know is I had to make a call. And what are you going to say as a coach then? And normally that you turn around and say, well, make sure you call in our favour next time. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Perfect.
But it is genuinely amazing how often that happens. And I'm put my hand up, have been no angel over the years as well. There are times where I've certainly been irate on the sidelines and things like that, but the easiest way to get me to calm down is like, yeah, I know what you saw, but here's how I saw it.
Yep.
So, you know, we can disagree about this as much as you want, but I saw it differently. Yeah. And it's like, well, how do I argue with that? Like, there's nowhere really to go in that space.
And that's where, like, I know it creates more talking, but sometimes I would say to referees, just ask them, hey, how did you see that? So you ask the coach.
Yep.
You know, you're bitching and carrying, you know, you jumped up and down. Oh, how did you see that, coach? And say, and half the time you won't even explain it properly. So you can pick them up on that. Well, you don't understand the rule, you know, because you've got the rule wrong. But, and secondly, it gives them the opportunity to say, and that's fair enough. If you saw it that way, unfortunately from where I was, I didn't see it that way.
Yep.
Now, what more are you going to say to that?
Yeah, there's nowhere to go.
There's nothing.
And that's the biggest thing, I think. And that's, I don't think it's actually through any fault of the referee. I can't believe I just said that. But, you know, I don't think it's through any fault of the referee. But the mechanics dictate that once you make a call, you go away from the benches. So you almost lose a little bit of that ability to talk to and talk through things with the coach because you're instructed to go away from them in that sense. So I don't think it's necessarily just the referee's fault there.
Like you know why that was created?
Yeah, probably coaches.
To avoid
coaches.
Between absolutely.
Avoid challenges and questioning from coaches all the time.
Yep. I suppose the only problem with that is then – it promotes yelling across the court. Yeah, and so,
which is then on the side of the referees because then they're saying you're yelling, therefore you get a technical foul, so therefore you can't challenge me, so don't yell.
Yeah.
That's part of the thinking.
Yep, that makes sense. So how do we work towards better coach-referee relationships? How do we get to that point? Like how do we solve 15 other things that are going to continue to bubble on for the dawn of time? But
ideally what I think authorities would like and people who run competitions is they would like no reactions from coaches. You know, that's the ideal. And you look at other sports, they're either away from the play. I mean, we got a unique sport.
Yeah, everyone's mic'd up for a start.
Absolutely. And I can't think of any other sports where the coach is so close to the referees. I mean, they can touch a referee. They are so close to the floor. So that makes our sport so unique. So therefore, we can't necessarily adopt all of the processes that other sports would have to sort of penalise people, you know, like in soccer and so on. So therefore, we have to have a little bit more of a leeway in terms of, hey, I'm close to you. I'm standing side by side and I'm not allowed to speak to you. I mean, that's just unnatural, really. Yep. But again, it then comes down to how you speak to somebody. And that's education of how you speak to somebody in the street.
Yeah, it doesn't change.
How you speak to a policeman, how you speak to the shopkeeper. The same sort of thing, you know. Like, and unfortunately, I think the politeness of people is going a little further away from what you would like. And as a consequence, that will have an impact on coaches speaking to referees and vice versa, I might add.
Yep.
You know, I want referees to be extremely polite and cop it on the chin a lot of the times because you know you've got the upper hand. At the end of the day, you're the one with the whistle. If he's giving me a hard time, you know, like if you want to be a smart ass, you can penalise them in any way, shape or form. So you have to be a good listener and you have to have – and I'm very much in favour of referees developing a number of responses they can give, you know, like a similar responses, because it's a pressure situation.
It's tough.
The ability to be able to respond, and this always happens, I promise you. You'd have an altercation or whatever, and then you go away, and then 2 minutes later you go, oh, why didn't I say that to him? You know, like
I say that every day talking to Zoe. I should have just said this.
And we all do. And so I say to referees, hey, just remember, like virtually jot those things down so the next time something else similar to that, or the other option too is you pick up on somebody else's, how Zoe responded to Rob when he's challenged you and whatever. Then you go, hey, I like that. You get a good response. I'll use that terminology. So that there's sort of ways that you can actually pick up, because it's not easy to learn how to respond appropriately to people when you're under massive pressure.
Yeah. Well, it's two responses. You've got to make a call and then you've got to almost defend your call. Absolutely. It feels like when someone comes at you.
And I mean, and the other thing I will always say to them is, look, I understand where you're coming from. All I know is I had to make a call.
Yep.
Right? I had to make a call. You may not agree with it. I used to say, oh, well, looking on video, I'll be wrong anyway. You know, like, so I'd admit to the fact that I was going to be wrong. I said, but I just have to make a call. And that, you know, and most coach, how do you answer that, Rob?
To be honest, it usually puts me in my place pretty quickly with silence. With I've got nowhere to go here.
Absolutely, because you don't have a response. You don't. Sure. Oh, well, the only other response is, well, I can make sure you call it my way the next time. You go, yeah, that's fine. I agree with that.
Yep.
You know, so you don't always have to justify what you've called. You can just say, I've had to do that because of the game.
Just make sure you don't imitate Zoe's responses to Rob because they're probably not they're probably not appropriate.
Yeah, but there's a little they're probably more connection not appropriate. There.
That will get you a tech. But it's one of those things, and I think everyone here would suggest the same thing. When you're dealing with domestic basketball with junior referees that are inexperienced, leave them alone.
Yeah.
Like we don't need to be on those refs. It's unfair on them. Like I joke about it a fair bit. That's like, well, okay, by the time you get a referee on a Saturday in your domestic game, there may be 16.
Yep.
They have the same level of experience of an under 10 player, and we certainly don't expect perfection from the players in under 10s. Like, we know there are going to be errors. They're still learning their craft. It's, you know, very few referees could get the 10,000 hours to make themselves masters at what they do.
Correct.
It's too difficult.
And the percentage, Rob, of those that will go on as well, like players, you know, like you're only going to get 3 or 4% that will go on and become
Sort of high level.
Into that higher level, yeah. So as a consequence, you're dealing with 97% of the people aren't going to do this in another 2 years' time anyway. You know, so they're you're right. But it's only human nature. It's understandable that you react to sort of things but it's just the way that you do come across a lot of the times as being
you've got to be a role model for the kids. Yeah. Like if they see the coach jumping up and down being irate, well, what are the players going to do? And you can usually tell.
Well, and it's something we talk about all the time, especially in those junior levels. If you'll help yourself with your reactions to any type of officiating if you stop caring so much about winning.
Mm.
If you go more back to development rather than winning, that will help because calls won't really matter to you as much as they would.
It's the last call of the game. There's a chance that they probably had a decision.
But over the course of a game, you know, if you're hanging your hat on the scoreboard, then every influence, including the officials, are going to become a really big deal.
And we're not telling anybody anything that people don't know. The reactions of the coaches then has a massive impact on the reactions of players. You know, so if you're a whinging coach, the chances are there's going to have players that are, and they use that as an excuse. I mean, that's
absolutely
that's part of their cop out of. You know, of being able to get away with things.
Yep. All right, a couple of just last questions, Bill, before we go. Best refereeing experience?
Oh, my goodness. Probably refereeing the Dream Team in Barcelona.
Yep. No, you didn't give up that you maybe missed a call there or anything like that? You were pretty forthright with what
game?
You did?
Yeah. Oh, sugar, yeah. I would have missed heaps of calls. Michael Jordan told me. This is what happened. I called a foul in his. It was for him, you know, so it was in his favour as he was making a move to the basket. But I said the foul occurred before he had actually got to complete the shot. So I cancelled the basket. He went bananas. It was like as if I'd called a foul, you know, like against him. And I'm going, hey, mate, it's in your favour.
And you're up by probably 50 points at this stage. Yeah.
Well, the closest anyone got was 30.
Yep.
Yeah. So. But so he was still capable of complaining.
Yep, not the Vince Carter incident.
Oh yeah, that's another one too.
Yeah. It's funny because Bill and I usually go and do the CEDA courses. So Bill goes in and takes the refereeing component. I go in and take the coaching one. I'm like, oh, how did your course go with Bill last week? And they're like, yeah, it was fun. They showed us the video of him getting run over by Vince Carter and breaking his arm. I'm like, oh, good, you know.
Which was 5 days out from the Sydney Olympics.
Yep,
which is sort of It was a, and I'm sure he did it intentionally. He knew who he was.
He knew where you were.
Who was the best player you ever reffed?
The best player.
Yep.
Oh, I wish you'd given me a heads up about this sort of thing. I could have
probably a fair point.
Could have had a think about it. It's pretty hard to go past Andrew, really. Gaze.
We are sitting in the Gaze room. It seems only fair.
And I've just looked up, and his dad's looking at me, but.
Was there anyone you just hated reffing?
Hated reffing?
Yeah.
No, but I didn't hate. Hate's probably too strong a word.
Yep.
I used to be challenged considerably by Bruce Palmer.
Yep.
And I love Bruce. I mean, it's not nothing to do. It's just that he was so intense and so emotional and so on that that he would give you a hard time and make things a little more difficult for you.
Bill, that's it.
That's it.
That's good. It. Good. Thank you very much for jumping on the podcast. It's a massive thing. I genuinely don't think we can undersell the impact that you've had on the sport in this officiating perspective. It's and I know there will be people that listen to this podcast, and I can see this coming now, and I'll be like, why can't we have more Bills? Like, and that's the respect that you still command years after you've retired from the actual on-court stuff.
But I think you always get better, Rob, after you've retired. <you're laughs> I can give you a lot of examples of people wouldn't necessarily be saying that.
I don't know. Time heals all wounds. There's been enough time that you haven't had to call the block charge and make that decision in particular. So, genuinely, Bill, I know we both work at Basketball Victoria and Zoe and myself, and you've been here the entire time I've been here, and obviously when Zoe has been too, and you've genuinely made it a fun place to be to work in here as well. I've genuinely enjoyed the game reviews on the Monday morning. They got a little bit spicy at times, but they were always part of the learning experience, as you said. It's but just the impact that you've had on a number of referees, and I do hope we don't lose you to the sport, or the sport doesn't lose you to it. There's so much knowledge and stuff to offer to our next lot of referees coming through, and hopefully a lot of coaches hear this and understand that, you know, there are people inside those referee shirts and not just black and white stripes that you get to yell at.
Rob, you know, it was a massive advantage for me actually working here, simply because of what you mentioned before, is the ability for us to have communication, you know, on a Monday or whatever. That was a massive learning curve from my perspective as well. You know, like, I'd go in and just try and justify every call that I made and, you know, sort of and support the referees to the nth degree. And then, but realistically, I'd go away and I'd think about what you've said and what you've discussed and what's bothered you, and sort of absorb all of that and take that into consideration. Whereas most other referees don't have that luxury of doing that. You know, the chances are when they see a coach, it's not the friendliest environment that you're in. Whereas we were able to, and that's what I really appreciated, the fact of being able to, and we could have heated discussions, as you say, but it was never nasty or it was never sort of, you know, like, well, I didn't think it was. But Rob's
No. There was usually,
I don't remember it being nasty.
There was usually more angst when Bill came around to collect the $2 for Tats Lotto and we hadn't won again. Like, that was when we probably got the nastiest.
Yeah, that's true. And I'd be pestering you to make sure you paid. But I mean, that I really appreciated that. And so I was lucky in lots of ways. For 32 years, I was working in basketball. And so even in my times when I first started and working for Basketball Australia, I had an office at the VBRA, at VBA, at Albert Park. And then I'll relate when you're talking about, I used to run the tipping competition as well.
Footy or basketball?
No, basketball.
Yeah, I feel like we're crossing into some integrity issues.
Well,
here.
We are probably NBL and WNBL. So I'd go around and collect the money and we'd get the tips and whatever else. Probably couldn't do it now, that's true. But I'll never forget this occasion. Lindsay was the manager of Basketball Victoria. So I went into Lindsay on the Friday and they were playing, I don't know, they were playing Brisbane, I think, the next day or whatever. And so I said, oh, Lindsay, you've got to put your tips in. And he said, Billy, who sees this? I said, oh, only me. I'm the only one that goes, okay, Brisbane. So he picked against his own team. So that was the sort of rapport that we would have.
Oh, and Bill was on the game and he made sure that Brisbane won.
And then if he bitched and carried on, I said, hey, Lindsay, you said that Brisbane are going to win anyway. So I was laughing.
No, look, a massive thanks, Bill. Like, it's Basketball Victoria is certainly in a better space because of the time and the effort you put in, and, you know, the coffee machine will get a nice reprieve from here on in.
Absolutely.
More than anything else. But thank you very much for jumping into the podcast, Bill. Thank you very much, Zoe, for jumping in. Coaches, we'll be back next week with another episode. But if you want to leave Bill some love in the comments on Facebook, or Bookface as he calls it, you're more than welcome. I can promise you he will never see it. But either way, thank you all very much for listening and we'll catch you next week.
That's true.